Hi guys, it's Munir Adam here. Welcome back to Primary Care UK. And as season two comes to an end, it's time for a recap. And that's what this episode is about. Yeah, that's right. So we're coming to the end of season two and it's been an exciting year. We've had some amazing contributions, some great topics we've discussed, all of which have been really relevant, useful for the multi-professional primary care community and for NHS workforce in general. And we've had great contributions from our multi-professional team from across the country. And we've all really enjoyed this. Everybody has found it great fun. And we hope you learned something and enjoyed it too. And we're now looking forward to season three, which starts on the 1st of April. So we're now going to do a recap, much like we did at the end of season one. And the reason for that, just to remind you, is first of all, as a way of reminding ourselves about the topics that were covered and some of the things that we learned. Sometimes just a few key words can bring a lot of memory and learning back to the forefront of our mind. And it also gives you a chance to think about whether you might want to go back and listen to any of those episodes again, just to brush up on the sorts of things that were covered. And also, not everybody has a chance to listen to all of the episodes, and some of them you may have skipped. And if that is the case, and perhaps you're thinking about listening to the ones that you have missed, then this brief run-through might help you decide. So let's do this. So season two kicked off with the all-important topic of time management. And we covered this over four episodes. And that's because time management is really important and is of concern, actually, to a lot of staff, clinical staff, especially working in primary care. There never seems to be enough time to get things done. And so looking at both the consultations and outside the consultation and a day-to-day work in practice, what can we do to save time and work more efficiently? And this was taught to us by Ed Pooley and by Professor Roger Naber. And then three of us working in the primary care team discussed it amongst ourselves in terms of what we can do to save time. Let's hear a snippet from first Ed Pooley and then Professor Roger Naber.
But if you're, say, a salary GP or an ANP or somebody else working in primary care, what are the things that you can do to improve time? And I think one of the most helpful things that certainly helped me was breaking down what you do into a series of tasks. So it may be that you can change the way that you ask questions so that you don't have to ask repeated questions. It may be that how you introduce yourself to the patient will save you time. It could be that the way you document things will save you time. So I see time management as
one of the things that we touched on earlier was this concept of ICE. So I like to modify that. So I go from ICE to ICEA. So I add an extra I in there, which stands for identity. So kind of understanding how that patient views themselves in the wider world, in the wider context.
If I were to ask you, is patient-centeredness a good thing, you'd say yes, you can't say no. Of course, I mean, but there's a bit of, I think, of some lack of clarity about what being patient-centered means. Being patient-centered does not mean that the patient gets what they want all the time. It doesn't mean that they're totally in charge of how the consultation unfolds and the time. Going back to my definition of a good consultation, which is one that takes a problem and converts it into a plan, anything that it takes to achieve that is patient-centered. And that means having in your repertoire not just the skills of listening and questioning and so forth, but it also means we need skills in moving things on.
Right, yes. See, the thing is, when we're feeling resourceful, we might function a lot better than if we're feeling drained and tired and rushed. And I've noticed time after time that I'll have a patient, for whatever reason, will run really late. And then what do I do for the next patient? I just call them in really quickly and I say to myself, I'm going to get through this one in 2 minutes. And of course, it never happens. It might take an extra couple of minutes, but it might have been better for me to leave the room, go and make myself coffee or go for a little walk.
Being a bit self-protective is actually a really important thing. I just keep cramming things in, doing more, you know, getting things done, working through my breaks. Like long term, that's not sustainable. You're going to burn out. You're probably not going to last in the job.
Can't argue with that, can we? Anyway, also early in season two, we covered the all important and serious topic of cancer, major killer in not just the Western world, probably everywhere. And this was very primary care focused and all about early diagnosis. So do have a listen to this if you haven't already. Here's a clip.
One thing I want to say about prostate is that demographics are really important here. Black men have twice the average population risk of prostate cancer, and any man who has a brother or father with prostate cancer is, particularly if at a young age, is at increased risk. So when you're thinking of investigating the prostate, always bear that in the back of your mind. What is their sort of background population risk? Because that may affect how you counsel someone about having a PSA test. One little bit of learning, which has been new for me, which is very niche, but it's worth sharing, is that transgender women, so people who were assigned male at birth, who have then transitioned to become female, do still have a prostate.
And as we move on, we remind ourselves that even as clinicians, just because we want to do something and know we can, and there's nobody stopping us, doesn't necessarily mean we will, because we are human beings at the end of the day. And so why would patients be any different? We can advise them as much as we like about what they should be doing differently to lead healthier lives. That doesn't mean they're going to be able to do it necessarily without the help. Where does that help come from? Health coaching with Caroline Haynes.
Yeah, if you think about all of the millions of diets out there and the wealth of information that we have, if someone wanted to find a diet plan, they could very easily find it. A lot of the time, doing these detrimental health behaviours is not because people don't know what's good for them and what's not good for them. It's because of some other underlying reason. So, you know, for example, I'm sure you know about the correlation between childhood experiences and adult obesity. You know, that's a really good example of how this underlying stress can cause obesity in later life. Patients living with obesity often feel judgment because of their weight, and I've had many patients say that they felt really patronized because people have told them to like eat less and exercise more, which is very reductive and not really helpful. And this is where a health and wellbeing coach can help.
And the powers that be decided that fit notes could now be done not just by doctors but by other health professionals as well. So are the doctors jealous that's happened? I really doubt it. But how prepared are we? And actually, how difficult could it? Why would you need to talk about this subject? That's what I first thought. But actually, I learned a few things myself too.
For Department of Work and Pensions, the idea behind the change of legislation is to include multi-professional teams to get more practical and qualitative information rather than only symptoms and diagnosis. So the information should include functionality of the patient as well. So, for example, their strength, their mobility, hearing, vision, sensory impact, what activities can't be done and for how long, whether they would need further appointment.
And then there's the big topic of patient access to records. It is, after all, their medical record, right, you might say? But I think it's fair to say that historically we've documented with the intention that it's for other clinicians to see, not with the expectation that the patient themselves may look at their record and even scrutinise it.
This is a really fundamental shift in our relationship with the care record. It's always been the medical record, and really it's becoming the patient record. And what does that mean for how we write in the notes? And I think it's also important for us to remember that we're not the first ones to be doing this. You know, many hospital consultants have been writing their letters to us, copying in the patient.
That's true. Yeah.
There are also increasingly, I'm noticing as a GP, letters coming in written to the patient with me copied in. And that.
We move away from the administrative and onto the workforce. And there were three sessions. The first one was about the nurse role and nurse opportunities. And another episode about the role of the general practice assistant, a role that I think is still poorly understood amongst clinicians in general. And after that, an episode on workforce transformation, something that's been big in the last few years, led by Dr. Rachel Roberts, Primary Care Dean for London, and with a team of different professionals talking about what this all means for them. Understanding each other's roles will help us work more effectively together, and it's one of the missions of the podcast. So we hope that you will or have had listened to those episodes. Let's start with the nurses and then the GPA role and then workforce transformation.
I think it's quite a steep learning curve. Lots of people mention that when you join general practice, you know, you're going into autonomous working and you can be in a room and you can feel that sometimes you can feel like you haven't got people to lean on and support. But actually, I think part of the networking and the peer support that people get is that you realise there's so many people out there who are really passionate about supporting general practice nurses. And actually, once you tap into those networks, you do find that there's so much help and assistance out there. I think
further. If I'm not wrong, roughly around more than 300 GPAs have already been trained in the same program.
Right. Okay, great. So it's taking off then. What I want to ask you is, for you, what would you say is the part of your job that you like the most or find the most rewarding, perhaps I should say? Work is work, isn't it?
I really like communicating it with the patients. I really like to bridge that gap between the patients and the primary care team members. And that's what we are here for, you know, patients coming for their clinical problems.
And there's something certainly about that transition from moving from, say, an ambulance service to a primary care. So there's some different skills, there's a different knowledge base. And for me, working within the ambulance service and going into the rotational working environment, certainly it's been the GPs, the practice nurses, the nurse leads and other professionals that I've come in contact with who have helped me build my confidence and feel better working in those environments, because I know some of the skills, I know some of the knowledge, but you put someone in a different environment and you suddenly feel like you're the new person all over again.
And then in the workforce, regardless of who we are and what our profession is, we may get affected by issues that are going on around us at a larger scale. And what with there being so much discussion about the major wars going on, both in the Middle East and in relation to Ukraine, we felt that this is something that may be affecting people and decided to cover the topic with support from the GMC, the General Medical Council. Innocent lives are being lost. Of course it's going to affect me. Like, you know, I come to work every day and that's all I'm hearing on the news. I can't just pretend, right, that I don't care about hundreds of people dying in the Middle East.
In a busy clinic, when a patient presents from a war-torn country, when they share their story, present with PTSD, the reality of their day-to-day and their story can affect us. I work in a military area where colleagues and patients live with anxiety and are faced with uncertainty every day. When will family members be deployed? Are they safe? When will they come back? How do we respond to all of these questions?
Well, one thing's for sure, what with emotions being high and us not really being prepared on this sort of thing, it's very easy to get it wrong. And so it would serve as a useful reminder. And what we also need to be reminded of, and often know very little about, is that the air that we breathe is polluted. And yes, it does take lives. And so a team of leaders and experts have been working on this to try to make a difference. And they remind us that as health professionals, we can make a difference. Let's hear from Professor Fenton.
Why is educating health professionals important? This is because climate change isn't just an environmental issue. It's a public health emergency. Health professionals are on the front lines, diagnosing and treating the consequences of poor air quality every day. Equipping them with the knowledge of these links empowers them to better advise patients, advocate for cleaner air policies, and ultimately protect our collective health.
Back to patient care, and the theme for the latter part of season two was about those who fall into vulnerable groups, and often the inverse care law applies, or they don't get the care that they should really be able to expect. We had a couple of episodes on advanced care planning, and that's in order to avoid patients from losing out when they are vulnerable by planning ahead. There's also an episode on homelessness, on those with learning disability, and those with mental health. Let's hear a clip from each of them.
We don't want to talk about it, but interestingly, it turns out that a lot of us are thinking about it.
Hmm.
So perhaps we just need to change a little bit, a tiny bit, in the direction of the ability to talk about those later stages of life. Because what people think is going to happen, it turns out, is a long way from what is actually now happening to many people towards the end of life. And I think they need to think about that and then think about what decisions we are able to make.
But she had tried to go to many GPs because she had abdominal pain, and in the end turned up in a homeless practice, which was completely inappropriate, really, given her circumstances. It turned out she had a big tumour in her abdomen.
Oh.
Fortunately, it turned out to be benign, but nevertheless, I think she'd been trying to get treatment for it for about 6 months, but because she'd been told you shouldn't go to A&E for just anything.
Yeah.
But she couldn't get into a GP.
Oh, no. These kind of examples scare me, because when you mention an example like this, it makes me think there must be so many others. Irina, who is our Nottinghamshire rep, interviewed two experts on the topics of learning disability and mental health.
Soon, we'll be implementing a reasonable adjustments digital flag. That will be on all patients' records within primary care. And we need to think a little bit further than that, because we're not thinking about, well, how does that person come to the GP surgery and what can we do about that? What we need to be doing on the front line is also thinking about, well, how does that person access the secondary care health appointment that we've made for them as a follow-up from our primary care appointment?
You know, I said it when I was talking to someone the other day, but for many years of working with people with mental health problems, people will often present wanting a solution. Many times they will ask for a prescription, but most often what I find is that people value the rapport and the relationship more than the prescription, and they won't sacrifice the rapport and relationship with someone that might help them to actually get to the bottom of and solve their mental health difficulty for the prescription.
And then an update on the infamous topic of COVID-19, taught by Emma Borders, Primary Care UK team lead in Cornwall. Do we think that this variant's going to be more pathogenic?
They don't know. We are sort of seeing science unfold as it happens, and that's what makes this really challenging. What we're seeing is, in the last 3 months, we had hospitalisation rates about 3 months prior, about 900 weekly, and we're up to about 4,000 now. And the deaths are following on a similar trajectory.
And in season two, we also covered the perennial relevant topic of lower back pain, presented by an expert from Guy's and St Thomas's. And we also did an episode about not just surviving, but thriving, presented by Dr. Rachel Morris, and so that we could look after ourselves too. But that's it for now. We hope you've enjoyed season two, that you've enjoyed some of the episodes, and if there are others that you haven't yet listened to, that you'll go back and listen to them. But not just that, tell your friends about them, spread the word. We'd love to have your feedback on Apple Podcasts and rate us. This is what keeps us going. Season 2 was sponsored and supported by Integrated Care Support Services, and we are very grateful to them for their support. A link to their website can be found in the show notes. And as we go into Season 3, if you'd like to sponsor one or more episodes, or you have a speaker, an expert, somebody that would like to get involved or teach us on a subject, then we'd love to hear from you. So, we hope that you join us back in Season 3. For now, keep well and keep safe.